Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness and mindset. Today's guest is hybrid athlete Fergus Crawley. Fergus recently took on a challenge where he called the 1200-12, which consisted of 1200-pound powerlifting total. So the three moves in powerlifting are your squat, deadlift and bench, and a sub-12 our iron distance triathlon in the same day. So an Ironman distance triathlon is a 3.9 kilometer swim, 180 kilometer bike ride, and a 42.2 kilometer run, so a marathon to finish. And today's podcast, we split it into two parts. The first half of the podcast is talking all about training and balancing endurance and strength. If you're into fitness, if you're into the gym, if you're into body composition or strength or endurance style training, you're going to love this. It's just bouncing back and forth on ways that you can find what excites you with your training and kind of following that path, whether it leads you to CrossFit or endurance or bodybuilding or whatever it is that you're following for interest levels. And then the second half of the podcast, we jump into mental health. Fergus has been very open on this podcast and in the past on his own channels about his suicide attempt in 2016 and his battle with depression. So the second half of today's podcast, we focus heavily on the mental health side of things. And as morbid as the topic is, Fergus has a great sense of humor and a way of putting across a message on living a life that makes you feel fulfilled and finding what makes you tick. So although I would preface this that we get into some particularly harsh topics, harsh isn't the right word, some particularly mind-opening topics that might feel uncomfortable, they're given and put across in a way that is digestible for sure and isn't as harsh and potentially soul-destroying as you may think. And I think that's a testament to Fergus putting out the message and destigmatizing mental health by talking about his own experience. So just, I wanted to preface with that. But that is today's podcast. Again, a lot of stuff we cover. Hybrid athlete Fergus Crawley on balancing endurance and strength, extreme challenges, and dealing with mental health. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Fergus Crawley. Fergus is a hybrid athlete who recently completed the 1200-12, which consisted of a 1200-pound powerlifting total and a sub-12-hour iron distance triathlon in the same day. Having competed in a variety of sports from a young age, Fergus has spent his life in pursuit of athletic performance. He completed his degree at Durham University, where he specialized and excelled as a powerlifter, competing internationally for several years, but more recently switched his focus back to hybrid performance and forging a path for others. Fergus shared his experience with mental health and a suicide attempt publicly in 2018 and has since used his athletic pursuits as a channel to raise funds and awareness for the cause. And he raised almost £100,000 for Movember through a variety of strength and endurance challenges. A student of both the UK SCA and NSCA syllabus, Fergus has now coached scores of athletes as they endeavour to push beyond their boundaries and apply the principles he embodies. I'm looking forward to talking all things endurance, the 1200-12 and mental health in today's episode. Fergus, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, and quite a comprehensive intro there.
Mate, you've done
very, very, very I had well to cut, rehearsed.
I had to cut that short. I was like, I literally had a list of things. I'm like, what will I pull from for the introduction? Because you've done so much, and I'm looking forward to kind of talking about your backstory and kind of what got you into fitness. We train in very similar ways, and when I came across your profile, I'm like, there's so much incredible stuff here. You do a lot about how to balance endurance and balance strength for people and breaking down those misconceptions. But before we get into any of that today, Fergus, talk about your background into fitness. Kind of what got you into it? I touched on it there, but I'm always curious with somebody who does what you do, the hybrid style, what kind of got you into fitness first and what got you kind of interested in it?
Yeah, so I was probably 14 years old when I really sort of found it as a pursuit I wanted to index a little bit more on. So I grew up playing a variety of sports, cricket, golf, rugby, football, skateboarding, snowboarding, kind of other things here or there. My dad was a professional cricketer, so grew up with that, but I grew up in Scotland, so it's not the most inspiring place in the world to pursue a career in cricket. Then moved schools in, I don't know, maybe 2008, give or take, whenever it was. Moved schools at some point when I was about 13 years old and kind of went into a much more focused rugby environment. So I took a bit of a step up there. S&C became a part of it. I enjoyed that side of things and sort of just learned basic movement patterns from the age of 14 to 16, 17. And then just as I was starting to sort of get into pathway stuff with rugby and actually kind of go in a direction that, well, assess what direction I wanted to go with it, whether it was something I wanted to pursue, whether I was actually capable of doing that, I had 3 concussions in 4 weeks. So that very quickly puts an end to any ambitions of a rugby career, let me tell you. So off the back of that, I just kept training as if I was going back to rugby. So just a bit of an eclectic mix of high intensity interval stuff. So just sort of running 2 for 22, just all the sort of Bronco style stuff that we've been doing up until that point. Standard S&C, so just practicing the big movements, and then just doing a bit more steady state endurance stuff as I was recovering from my concussions and just kind of being a bit lost with what direction I was going to go in. At that point, I quickly fell in love with the self-driven, simple metrics that health and fitness gave me. And I went from 105 kilos from the age of 15 to 16, 17 to 76 in about 6 months. So a very, very drastic weight loss, just because I became so obsessed, honestly, for the metrics that health and fitness gave me. I was in control of my food. I was really monitoring my calories. I was spending all hours of the evening on bodybuilding.com forums, which isn't necessarily the best thing you can do. But at the time, that was what I did. Got down 76 kilos. I was running 10Ks and 5Ks every week, was lifting 3 to 4 times a week, and was doing it because I enjoyed it. And the issue there is I was doing as much as I could because I enjoyed it, but I wasn't doing it with much structure other than the basic information I could find online. So I ended up tearing my calf in my final year at school, just before I was due to do my first Olympic distance triathlon. It wasn't too bad a tear, so I was quickly back to lifting, etc., but I couldn't really run for a while. And then I met a good friend of mine who got me into powerlifting, and I thought, you know what, whilst I can't run properly, let's just index harder on the big three and see how far I can push it. So I did my first competition in early 2013, and then competed all over the world from that point onwards through to 2017. And once we hit 2017, I did the British Championships with the GPC. I had been living and working in London at that point and had been traveling an hour each direction to get to a gym that had all the facilities, deadlift bars, monoliths, all this equipment, and just an environment that I wanted to train in. And then did my final competition, well, did my most recent competition, rather, should I say, and just kind of was in the car on the way home, just not that enthused by it. I just didn't get, it didn't seem worth it. It didn't seem like all the time sacrifice and the late nights and the travel and just the investment into it was as worth it as it had previously been. I wasn't as emotionally invested as I had been. So kind of just went back to a mix of strength and hypertrophy training too, because I enjoyed it for a little while. And then in 2018, around this time of the year, so mid-August 2018, I started to slip back into a state of depression, which I'll give the context for later on, I'm sure, and recognized the situation I was in as, you are going back towards depression, don't do what you did last time and ignore this, tackle it head on, and thought, what were you missing last time? A sense of fulfillment. Therefore, what do you need to try and see if you can feel better? A sense of fulfillment. So I went out and found one. I thought, okay, what are you good at? You're good at squatting. And charity, what can you do? You can do stuff for Movember. They've done some stuff with rugby in the past. Good charity to work for, men's mental health focused. That's got a personal meaning for me. Nobody knows that yet, but I'll do something for charity around squatting. And then logically, as everybody would assumedly do, I set off on the mission to squat 500,000 kilos in 24 hours.
Jeez.
Which ostensibly is a strength challenge because it's a lot of squats, but in reality, it's actually an ultra endurance event. So my squat, I was faced with the challenge of keeping my strength base as high as I possibly could whilst bringing up my aerobic base as high as I possibly could. So I started going out on long, steady runs, started doing much more interval work, started actually just really engaging with the endurance stuff again in 2018. And fell back in love with it because it'd been the first time since I've been at school where I was doing it at a level. But for so long, I'd put it off because I'd fallen back into that trap of, oh, I don't want to do any cardio because it might reduce my overall strength. It got to the point where I wasn't even playing golf at the weekend because I didn't want to play golf on a Saturday because I didn't want 12,000 steps on my legs ahead of my heavy squats on a Monday. But I enjoy playing golf and I didn't even enjoy the squatting that much anymore. So it was just, I got into this twisted manage your life around your training, but at the sake of it, while sacrificing my own enjoyment, weird headspace. And the first Movember campaign is ultimately what sort of set me onto this hybrid path that I'm now on. So that's a very long-winded context, but I'm sure we'll fill in the gaps from 2018 until now as we go. But that's sort of the context that got me back to being the strength and endurance version of myself. But I think the overarching discovery I've made is that I've got short femurs, which means my squat is better than it is for my body weight than most people. That squat's the same as my deadlift. I'm not necessarily that fantastic at any one thing, but my brother's the same. We're both very adaptable to new demands, and we're both very good at translating work ethic into adaptation. And I think we are genetically lucky in that sense that we can apply ourselves to new demands at the right volume, at the right intensity, and we can really reap the rewards in quite short periods overall. But my ambition now is basically to never be more than 3 to 4 months away from specializing in any event that I practice frequently. So whether that's a strength activity, whether that's an endurance activity, whether that's a show of speed or whatever, I reckon I'm only 3 or 4 months away from specializing my training into being competent at a discipline that I practice in.
There's so much to unpack there, Fergus. It kind of echoes, I've had, you know, I know we both know Ross Edgley. He's been on the podcast a couple of times, and it echoes that of, you know, not particularly brilliant at anything, but able to turn their hand at nearly most things, which is, I think itself, actually more impressive as an athlete that, you know, particularly the 12-1200, which we're going to unpack now. But before we do that, and we're going to double back on a few things, you mentioned there in 2017 about not being enthused by what you were doing anymore. And is that something, and again, wasn't kind of anything I had pre-planned to ask, but just you've given me a nice little intro into it. Is that something you listen to regularly? So one of the things I'm always curious about with people who do these crazy challenges is obviously finding that motivation to do it. Do you use that enthusiasm and what excites you to decide on what you're going to do next? And was 2017 kind of the first way that you transitioned out of that? Or how do you decide on what kind of events you're going to do, whether it's, you know, squatting 500,000, is it kilos or pounds? I can't remember the metric for the Movember challenge, but any of the kilos, yeah, like, which is just insane. And that, or the 1212, which we'll get into, how do you decide what challenges you're going to take? Well, what's the voice, or what's the, is it talking with trainers or friends or family members, or is it you wake up in the morning and it just hits you? What does that look like?
So Brian, I tend to lock myself in a dark room and put on some death metal and just see what pops up into my head. No, I'm kidding. It's much more. It's much
everybody
more
on the other side, death metal, dark room.
Write that one down. Yeah. No. So the key bit is 2017. You sort of hit the nail on the head there with that being a bit of a sort of break in the story, or a volta in the experience for me, because I suffered from depression for 2 years in silence and attempted suicide in 2016. As I've said, I'm sure we'll unpack that a little bit more as we go. And that's kind of the crux of a lot of what I do now in terms of the way that I develop the narrative around these things and my own experiences. But but basically from 2016 through to that powerlifting competition, I'd been living and working in London. And honestly, I was just going through the motions. I wasn't the best version of myself, but I was happy being happy again. So I was drinking more than I normally would. I was kind of a little bit more relaxed about my training, a little bit more relaxed about my habits. And honestly, I was just happy to not be miserable, for want of a better phrase. And because powerlifting had been a huge part of my life, and actually probably one of the reasons I managed to suffer for so long with depression, was because I had powerlifting training. So when it became apparent that actually my love for that had died and dwindled a little bit, I was faced with a bit of a break point where I thought, okay, well, what do you do if you just go through the motions in your day-to-day job, your day-to-day life, then actually what else do you do? And that's where the self-awareness that I'm now very well tuned into for myself started to really, really develop and actually really start to reflect and question my own viewpoints, my own thoughts, my own perspectives on things. And once I realized actually, okay, powerlifting was your sense of fulfillment. That's maybe not what it once was. How do we translate that into something else so that you don't end up being miserable again? Because honestly, I was just terrified of feeling the way that I did previously. So that's what led me to, it's also a bit of a creative expression because I sat down and I thought, well, my first challenge was I didn't want to share publicly the experience that I'd had, but I did want to do something for the cause. So I thought by doing a physical challenge, that would draw people in. And by proxy, they would therefore engage with the charity and the cause because I didn't want the cause to be the forefront because then people might start asking questions that I didn't want to answer. So I thought, okay, if you use 500,000, which is the global male suicide rate, well, it was in 2018, and try and squat that number, then you'll draw people in with the squat challenge rather than the statistic, but they will to avoid the statistics. So I'm kind of hiding my true intentions a little bit, or at least I thought it was. But after 2 weeks, I realized that actually people were so engaged with the cause and the project that it ultimately gave me the confidence to actually lead with that and talk about my own story publicly. And then I realized that using the statistics as the focal point for the challenge was quite a neat way of actually bringing people on board, and it was a really good way of communicating it. So that's what I did that year. That's what I did in 2019 for the Movember challenges. It's what I did in 2020 to some degree as well. But I think at this point, it's important to make the distinction that I've got two sides to my sort of athletic pursuits, I guess. One is my creative campaigns, I guess I could call them, my creative charity campaigns, whereby I sort of use my athletic abilities to draw attention to statistics and bring people on a journey with me in terms of the challenges themselves. So 2018 was the squat challenge. 2019 was a series of three challenges throughout November. And 2020 was something called Project Vertical, which was continuously ascending Ben Nevis for 11 days, basically. But we'll get into that, I'm sure. And that was all the charity stuff. So that was basically just kind of a combination of endurance stuff on its own. And then there's the actual more self-fulfilling just athletic pursuits. So things like the 500-pound squat and sub 5-minute mile in the same day last year. And then the reason I came up with the premise, well, the reason I came up with the idea for the 12-under-12 because I was playing on that premise. So for those that don't know, the 500-pound squat and sub 5-minute mile was coined in CrossFit Level 1 years, maybe 11 years ago, I don't know, a long time ago, as the ideal CrossFit athlete would be able to do this. And for 11 years or however long it's been, people have been trying and failing. Nobody has ever done it. And then within 2 weeks last year in July 2020, me and an American did it within 2 weeks of one another. And that premise landed really well. People sort of thought, wow, this is a cool thing to be done. And the 505 was the premise that I played on for the 1212. And it just so happened that the Iron Distance Triathlon I signed up for landed on the exact same day, the exact same Sunday, 1 year later from the 500-pound squat and the sub 500 miles. So I thought, right, there's a blank canvas here for you, Fergus. How are you going to make this into something similar? And I thought, okay, sub 12 Ironman is sort of the goal that most recreational age
athletes. That's a fast Ironman, just for context for people, which we will get into, just because for those who aren't familiar with Ironman, that's a incredibly fast Ironman distance time.
It's sort of the one that it's the final bucket list before sub 10, and sub 10 is where you're like you're bordering on pushing for pro at that point. That's where you start to really, really make a decision on what direction you take it. And so I thought, okay, I should be capable of a sub 12 one way or another, and I reckon I can hold on to a 1,200-pound powerlifting total. So 1,212, the exact same premise as the 505, but with a completely different demand, where it was across more lifts. Yes, the strength element, a 1,200-pound total is less demanding than a 500-pound squat, but in my mind, having done both, the demand from a sub-12 Ironman is significantly more complex than demand from a sub-5-minute mile. A sub-5-minute mile getting there at 92.5 kilos, don't get me wrong, was some of the most demanding training I've ever done, like lung busting, headachy, lying on the floor, rolling around, being sick, track sessions, where I had no concept of how I was ever going to move again. But the demand from pure endurance training to be able to sustain that over 12 hours across three disciplines is a very, very different challenge. And especially when you consider how much all that additional volume takes from your adaptive energy for the strength stuff. So basically it was, I don't know, it's, I wouldn't call myself an artist in any sense, but it's how I express myself through not being attached to any sport individually. Like I don't have a calendar where I know I need to perform from X to Y. So I need to try and find my own outlets for channeling my abilities, I guess. And this is sort of where I found, I mean, I've got a few ideas for how I can play in the premise again in the future, but I'm kind of running out of neat little number combinations. But at the end of the day, these are completely arbitrary numbers. All I'm doing is kind of balancing strength and endurance concurrently and using the sort of campaign and the numbers as a way of drawing attention to that. Because the whole thing behind this is, I operate at X level in terms of outputs, but as I've said, that's largely down to the fact that I'm quite adaptive to a variety of demands. But all I want people to do is broaden their horizons with training and not feel that they're confined to the boundaries and limits that they set themselves. And for so long, people have been told, oh, you can't run and lift. And if you want to go and do park runs every Saturday morning with your mates and just do it, shoot for a sub 25 in 6 weeks' time, but still train like a bodybuilder, you can absolutely do that. It just means that you need to consider things a bit differently. But so many people stop doing the things that they enjoy because of the fear that it might inhibit them in some other way, when in reality, you just need to consider things a bit differently and be a bit more analytical with it and understand that you're not going to be absolutely optimal across all disciplines. But that doesn't really matter unless you're aiming to be top of your game in them. And the reason most people train is for some sense of fulfillment, whether it's for physical appearance results. I mean, there are still things that you can do along the way that make that easier, that you can enjoy, whether it's, I mean, going on a trail run might be something you enjoy. That's a great way that you can improve your physical appearance by putting yourself in a calorie deficit. But don't feel that you can't go on a long trail run if you enjoy going on long trail runs because you're worried about the upper body session you've got to do in 2 days. And I've just gained so much from this variety of training, from pushing myself, from putting myself in the outdoors, from pushing my own boundaries concurrently. I know how rewarding it's been for me to become much more multidimensional, especially when I compare it to how miserable I was becoming when I was training in a one-dimensional way. All I aim to encourage people with what I'm doing is to broaden their training horizons and to use training as a healthy outlet for what they enjoy, rather than it seeming like they're stuck in this one way of doing things and they can never break out of it. Because I've been there before, and had I not realized that I wasn't enjoying it, I very easily could have just become a miserable powerlifter, not really progressing for 3 more years, and we wouldn't be having this conversation.
I think that's great advice, Fergus. Like, one of the things I connect very much with your content and what you've said there is, like, I get that training ADHD as well. Like, I'll do 6 weeks of CrossFit, 6 weeks of bodybuilding, then I'll prepare for a 100-mile ultramarathon, then I'll prepare that the last couple of Ironmans have been cancelled because of COVID in Ireland. But that training ADHD is very useful, very similar to what you've said. It's following what you're interested in doing right now. And based on what you're training for, you know, very similar to you, I train for my head. Like, it gives me massive relief from somebody that's had a history of mental health issues as well. So I want to park on that for a second. Is, you mentioned the depression side there. And again, I get that. I've experienced that myself, more so environmental. But mine, I was on the other side of the coin and the other side of the spectrum with kind of panic attacks from anxiety. But I completely get, yeah, they're two sides of the same coin in terms of your own biggest enemy is living right between your two ears. Is depression something that you've always suffered with or struggled with, or was it environmental based that it pops up now and again based on, you know, what kind of feedback that you're feeling unfulfilled? Or is it something that you've always struggled with?
Kind of multifaceted answer here, I think. I think in the sense that my experience was purely environmental, but exacerbated by the fact that my personality and the way that I interact with the world is, well, makes me susceptible to those environmental conditions. So I basically discovered hard work after, well, basically my second year of GCSEs. So I went from being a kid that was almost expelled from a school for doing no work whatsoever and just being a general nuisance. I honestly was just falling asleep in classes. I just had no ambition to do anything other than get home and play Modern Warfare 2 for
that
years.
That was a great game, to be
it
fair.
It was a great game. I'm not underplaying that by any stretch. It was the glory years, but nonetheless, I wasn't doing any work. And moved schools and actually discovered that in a smaller environment, etc., I had some ability that I could translate into grades, and then discovered that hard work equaled good, better grades, and kind of got a taste of that. And went from being a kid that was almost getting expelled and never going to university to becoming an Oxbridge candidate at the school I was at. I got really good results in my A-levels and ultimately didn't get into Oxford post-interview because I found out not long afterwards that four of the candidates that got into the course that I wanted to do, the headmaster of the school they went to was a fellow of the college, funnily enough. Thought that stuff doesn't happen anymore, Oxbridge. But nonetheless, I didn't get in, and that was the first big blow that I'd had on this sort of journey that I'd been on, of realizing that actually, if I put in work and develop myself, there are results waiting at the other end, and I became quite obsessed with that. So what it did was it meant that my metrics for success and the way in which I approached things became very black and white, in that do the work, reap the rewards, do the work, reap the rewards, etc. And that was the same with training. That was basically just you are in control of your own destiny. I kind of got into this false sense of security that I was in control of everything around me. And I went to university and I was surrounded by non-like-minded people. The halls to the left of me were entirely Chinese postgraduates, which is not an issue, obviously, but just they kept themselves to themselves because they were all, it was weird. It was like the university segregated my halls of residence into these little groups. So it was all Chinese postgraduates to my left. The entire floor above me were all people that had done a gap year, done a year at another university, and then started again. And that was all of them. The floor below me were all girls that were within 15 miles of the university, and then my floor was just like everybody else. So it was really weird. It was like from the off, it was like we were forced into these segregated little groups, and basically lovely people, but not like-minded. I didn't get on with them quickly, and I felt like I didn't have control. And what that did is it started to push me back a little bit. And then because I was a successful young man, I had these big ambitions. I was quite literally strong at the time. I was the one that got the good grades, the one that did this, X, Y, and Z. I had these high expectations of myself. I didn't acknowledge how much this was affecting me and how uncomfortable I was with this loss of control. And basically from October 2014, over the next 2 years, I got into a more and more aggressive form of depression that's been retrospectively diagnosed, because the key element is that for 2 years, I didn't say a word to anybody about the way that I was feeling.
That's the problem with it, though. It's just you keep it all bottled up and internal. I think that's why it's so important not to cut across you. Apologies, but just for people listening to speak out on it, I think it's really, really important. Sorry, Fergus, I wanted to add that.
100%, that's where I went wrong. And one of the key things that I talk about now is the fact that that's one of the biggest mistakes that I made. And the biggest, I felt that I was a freak, felt that I was alone, felt that I was unique for feeling the way that I do. But having since gone on this journey of sharing my story and actually having these conversations with people that have been in a similar position, I wasn't unique at all. I was just another human being whose sense of fulfillment wasn't being met, and I wasn't in the right environment. But my mistake was not realizing that there were things that I could do to improve that, one of which was talking to those around me. But my fear was I'd be rendered weak, I'd be judged as useless, I'd be judged as a failure if I said I'm feeling this way. So for 2 years, it got worse and worse and worse. I had training throughout it, yes. But then as a young man who thought he was higher than life and thought I was completely in control of everything, I genuinely, honestly didn't believe in the notion of depression or the concept of mental health, sorry, the reality of mental health, because I thought it was a convenient excuse that people could use to avoid responsibility, to get out of sort of hard work and to avoid developing themselves, basically. And then I was getting split in half at the gym by weights that I should be able to do with my eyes closed. I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, and I was being physically affected by the manifestation of my poor mental health. And then, all of a sudden, it became rather overwhelmingly real. And I realized that it wasn't just an excuse for people to use. It wasn't a convenient way out of responsibility. And then a week went by where I didn't say a word out loud to another human being other than like a barista or a Tesco cashier or a train conductor or something like that. Like I didn't have a tangible exchange with another human being that wasn't automated, shall we say. And the timeline's exactly around that, but I consciously realized a week had gone by where I'd basically been completely on my own. And that's where things start to degrade and it all becomes a bit blurry. But last year, almost a year ago, I went back into my WhatsApp messages and looked around the context and the date around early May of 2016 when my mum sent us a message to the family WhatsApp group saying, with a newspaper article explaining that a young girl has sadly passed away as a result of having peanuts in a curry that she'd ordered. And I'm allergic to peanuts. So my mum was quite literally just sending across basically a message that translated as, here's an example of something I don't want to happen to you. I care about you. Please be careful. And I was like, yeah, cool. And then she said, how's life with the boys? So me and my brother. And I responded at about 7:15 p.m. saying, I'm fine. How's life with everyone else? My exact words. And 2 hours later, I attempted suicide. And when I came around in a puddle of my own vomit, sorry to be explicit, about what I think was 14 hours later, I was overwhelmed with a sense of rage, not at the fact that I'd attempted suicide, but because it hadn't worked. And the one initiative I'd taken to try and improve my state of mind hadn't come off. So I felt more of a failure then than I had done previously. But as time passed and I was lying there so intoxicated, I could barely move, I was just thinking and I actually thought, no, this is a desperate situation that you need to take tangible action to get out of, and came around and realized how desperate the situation I was in was and that things needed to change. And ultimately, my solution came in the form of a 14-week-old French bulldog, as 2 weeks later I had a Frenchie called Odie. He's now known as Pig because he snores so much, but his government name is Odie, and brought him back down from Edinburgh to Newcastle, where I was staying at the time, and very quickly, just walking him around the northeast, I was speaking to people again, not about the fact that I'd attempted suicide and having deep psychoanalytical conversations, but oh, how's he doing? How's his toilet training? How old is he? What sort? Is he a pug? No, he's not a pug. All these conversations, but I was talking to people again for the first time in a long time. That slowly allowed me to build up confidence, to have a bit more of a routine, a bit more structure, a bit more confidence just talking to people on a day-to-day basis, because I'd been so alone for such a long time. I felt quite socially anxious, which is just not something that I've ever really understood other than when I was in that situation. And basically, he allowed me to reclaim my sense of self and sense of purpose over the next 6 months, to the point where it's Christmas time of that year. My mom had never wanted a dog. She'd made it very clear. And then all of a sudden, I'd sprung a dog on her and I was home for Christmas. So the elephant in the room, or the French bulldog in the room, rather, came up in conversation. And I just had to explain, look, this is why I've got him. And that was when that was the first encounter where I'd actually shared the way that I'd been feeling and how that had ended with the suicide attempt. So almost 6 months after the actual attempt itself was the first time that I, as a man, felt comfortable sharing that with other people, because I was still so fearful of being judged and rendered weak, useless, a failure, all these things that I'd felt up until that point. But sharing that with them was one of the most liberating things I've ever done. And then, as I said earlier, I used the time from that point onwards just to be happy being happy. I really enjoyed my third year at university, had a great time, came away with the result that I wanted, and started a full-time job in London. So graduated on the Friday and started a full-time job on the Monday. So the shortest summer holidays ever. Thank you very much, Heineken, for that one. But yeah, started a full-time job with Heineken on their graduate scheme in 2017. Was it 2017? Yeah, it was 2017. And then kind of went through there. So three months with Heineken in London on their fast track grad scheme, where there was a place. There were six of us and there was a place for a full-time job at the end of it. I got that full-time job. So 3 months out of university, I had finished my graduate scheme and I was in a full-time position in London. And as I said, that was where I'd kind of just started to go through the motions, enjoy being happy, enjoy being in a new city, training, traveling, and then did my last powerlifting competition. Wasn't very enthused with it. And there we are. That's kind of fills in the gaps in the story. But yeah, the big mistakes I made, obviously, as we've touched on, are the fact that I went into it with a very black and white metric system for success, which ultimately meant that whenever I felt that I was deviating from the path that I'd set myself in my head, I felt like I was a failure. Whereas now I'm much more malleable to the reality of the situation, as you've said, the environment that I'm in. So setting a plan's great, setting these ambitions are great, but the roadmaps are going to be always changing on how you get there. And rolling with the punches and adapting as you go is where the real value lies. And I mean, I was 18 years old and I'd set out my life from exam results to university to job to promotion to house to holiday to car to all these very traditional metric systems of success that ultimately mean nothing to me now. I never really did, but it was what I felt like I should be doing. And I felt like I could be a really successful, quote unquote, version of that traditional ladder, I guess. And that was ultimately my downfall, because as soon as I felt like I was doing something that wasn't contributing to that journey, I felt like I was failing. And I was very hard on myself. I had high expectations of myself and I kept this all to myself. So that ultimately led to me feeling the way that I did. And as I've said, the key was in 2018, when I remember it really well. I was sitting in a coffee shop in Brixton, I had a salted caramel brownie and flat white. And I opened my laptop and just got hit with this white noise. Sort of panic, shut my laptop and thought, fuck, what's that all about? Okay, you've been here before. This is sort of you slipping back into a state of depression. And my first thought, what's mad is my first thought then was, I'll just crack on, just get on with it. Like I just defaulted to that masculine, keep calm, carry on bollocks that got me to a suicide attempt in the first time around. And then actually thought, no, you've been here before, look how that ended. Do the right thing and try and get yourself out of this. But again, what's fascinating is my first thought wasn't share it with someone. My first thought was take it into your own hands. But I did have the self-awareness and the foresight to think, okay, you were missing fulfillment, find one. And honestly, that decision then, that turning point in my life has kind of really put me where I am today and kind of allowed me to follow that as a passion, as a hobby for the past three, four. So I left full-time work in March. So I've been working full-time since 2018 with the charity campaigns, et cetera. Huge personal investment, huge time investment, huge training investment. And I've kind of just been doing it because I enjoy it. It's very meaningful for me. But it's now ultimately become a way that I can work as a full-time career, which is incredible. But basically, I've just been accidentally making it up as I go along because I care about it and because it's important to me. And that's now become a career and something that I'm very proud to be able to invest most of my time in, because it's just, I don't know, it's just, I don't like some people on this planet. It's fair to say. Some people that I'd call some words that I won't utter here, but I would never wish my experience on my worst enemy, because it was just horrible. And suffering through it alone was something that I honestly, in a rational state of mind now, not being depressed, I can't comprehend how I felt the way that I did, how I let myself get that bad, how I didn't share it with people, etc. But what's important to understand is that depression isn't a rational state of mind. You'll know from the anxiety side of things, it's not a rational state of mind. And as a society, we so often try to break down and understand these things so that we can try and prescribe solutions to them. But it's not as simple as that. And I think I try and look at depression from the bottom up rather than the top down, in the sense that if somebody's depressed, let's not work backwards. Let's sort of work forwards from who they are as a person. So for me now, if I was to slip into depression, you'd look at, okay, what are the things that make Fergus tick? How many of those is he doing on a day-to-day basis? And I guarantee, because of my understanding now, you'd be able to quite quickly realize, okay, he's not training as often as he is. He's lost his habits around this. He's not actually doing a job that he enjoys. He's not spending enough time outdoors. He's not seeing the people that he loves frequently enough. He's not getting enough time to switch off from the stress of day-to-day life. And if I just changed all those things, the ripple effect of that would probably be enough to pull me out of depression. So it's very much environmentally influenced. But I think the biggest lesson I've learned is the awareness of that environment, knowing what makes me tick and trying to rigidly and strictly stick to that because I know it's what's best for my overall well-being. And I mean, I've got a lot of years ahead of me, and I'm very lucky in a sense to have gone through what I've gone, because it's given me this sense of perspective on my own existence that it probably takes people a lot longer to come to. But I've come to that through a very negative experience. But you don't need to go through a negative experience to understand the lessons to be learned. And I'm not professing to be the oracle on it in any sense, but sharing how you feel with people openly and honestly does not make you any weaker. It actually makes you much stronger, because it allows you to be much more sort of empathetic and much more considered around people around you. And the more self-aware you are, the more resilient you can become, because there's less surprises that are going to present themselves at you when you're actually suffering through adversity. And that's why I train the way that I do, and I do the things that I do, because I know that when I'm in a deep, dark hole 90 miles deep on something and I just want to quit, that's a part of myself and a state of reflection that I can only get to in that situation. But that's where I am the truest and most honest version of myself, and that's where the most profound lessons are to be learned, and where I actually take the most value and the most lessons that I can implement into my own day-to-day life moving forwards. So I'm just in a constant state of exploration, having come from a very negative, closed-minded existence. So I think the comparison and the biggest shift for me has been changing my metrics for success from wealth, prestige, power, job title, position, car, holidays, bank account, all that stuff, to how much time can I spend with the people that I love doing the things that I enjoy. And if I'm doing that, then I'm very successful in my mind, and that's how I view other people too.
There's so much to take from there. I think that question, Fergus, what makes me tick, is, and that prevention being better than cure when it comes to mental health. Again, I do something very similar. I have kind of signs that my mental health is deteriorating a little bit, you know, making excuses not to see the people closest to me, like little things. I'm like, oh, right, I need to kind of pull back this. Or for me, I could spend hours going through social media. So I have quite a good relationship with that now. And that's just me trying to numb out. And it's normally a sign that I'm feeling unfulfilled in a particular area. And it's a slippery slope from that point. So I think for people listening, because there may be some listening who are in the midst of depression at the minute or struggling with mental health, but there's probably a larger proportion of people who have experienced it previously or will experience it in the future. And understanding the signs that you're deteriorating, or you're starting to feel these negative emotions again, to get on top of it then by asking, you know, what makes you tick? Are you training? Are you sleeping? Are you getting out into nature? Are you spending time with loved ones? And you also said something there, Fergus, that I want to pull up about, you know, suffering through mental health and talking to people. I think what I generally tell people, and the analogy I use for people who are like, you know, just man up and suffer through it, I'm like, that's like training with an injury. I'm like, if you saw somebody training with a really bad injury, if they've, you know, a dislocation of a knee and then they go squat, I'm like, that's stupid. I'm like, don't do that. You know, rehab out properly, train around it by all means. But suffering through mental health is the same. I'm like, not talking to people is like training with an injury. It's not smart. It's not helpful. It's not useful. And I think using that sometimes can be enough to get people to just open up about it. Fergus, is that, if you could go back knowing what you know now, particularly around the mental health side, is the biggest thing to open up and talk to people? Or is there something else or other things that you use that you wish you had known now, or that you share with other people that you wish you had known back then?
Again, multifaceted in some sense, because yes, I believe the generalized universal starting point for this is talking, being open and honest, but it would be completely disingenuous and dishonest of me to suggest that that is the solution for all of us, in the sense that antidepressants might be a very useful tool for some people. People might need therapy. People might need more severe preventative measures. People might need medical attention. But the only way that we can find those solutions within our support networks, within those close to us, is by having that open conversation. And actually, first and foremost, being honest with ourselves internally, because what I didn't mention before was I didn't actually really acknowledge the reality of how I was feeling until I was walking with Odie and kind of just saying, dog owners will understand, but just sort of saying things out loud without thinking. And there are a few moments I remember where I said things out loud, like, oh, we're going to be okay, aren't we, Pig? And as I said them, I kind of like almost reached out to grab them, to kind of grab the words and shove them back down my throat, because they scared me that actually, oh no, if you're acknowledging that you're depressed or feel this way, then it's real, and then you are a failure, and you're not just thinking you're a failure, you are. And once I became comfortable with my own reality in my own head, that allowed me ultimately to become comfortable sharing it with others. And what that allowed me to do is explore other avenues to therefore give me the toolbox that I need to understand my own mental health, because it's a sliding scale. It's not a phrase that really winds me, it doesn't wind me up, but it's something that I'd like to try and help mitigate, is people that say, oh, he's suffering with mental health, or I'm lucky I don't have mental health, in the context of I don't suffer with it. But everybody has mental health, and saying that we all have physical health, and it's a sliding scale from good to bad, healthy to unhealthy, in the same way that if we eat nutritious food, dense micronutrition, in a sort of calorie controlled diet, focus on not binge eating, all these things, then we're on the healthier side of physical health nutritionally. But if we're eating highly processed food, grazing, not really moving, over-indexing on sodium, all these things that we all know, then we're going to be on the unhealthy side of it. In the same way that if we're consuming healthy, educating content, if we're doing the things that we enjoy, if we're spending time with people who we love, if we're doing a job that we enjoy, if we have hobbies that we enjoy, if we're spending time outdoors, we'll be on the healthier side of mental health. If we are going through the motions in a job that we don't love, if we're drowning our sorrows with alcohol or drugs or whatever, then we're going to be on the unhealthy side. It's not something you have or you don't. It's a sliding scale. So when people say, I'm lucky I don't have mental health, or they're suffering with mental health, the key distinction is the phrasing, because it's there's a different, again, mental illness, depression, anxiety, these things are the forms of mental illness. And in the same way that we can have a cold, you are physically ill. But it's the stigmatization around that phrase is very complex, which is why I really encourage people to consider it differently, because we all have mental health, but you can have poor mental health. So they are suffering from poor mental health, or they are having a negative experience with that. It's just the wording around it. It helps destigmatize it. And things like the conversations that, I mean, it's my dad's actually used that phrase specifically. He said, because he runs a brewery in the Northwest, he's been up against it hundreds of times, twice a week, just fighting fires all the time. And he said, I'm lucky I don't have mental health, otherwise I would have crumbled by this point. I said, well, no, you do have it. You're just lucky that you're incredibly resilient and self-aware on the things that you need to keep it healthy and functioning, so that you are not crumbling. There's a key difference there, and that understanding is something that I think will help destigmatize the language around it long term, but also will help individuals understand that everybody is susceptible to negative experiences with their own mental health. Just because you're not now doesn't mean you won't be in the future. The phrase midlife crisis has been thrown around and joked around for years and years and years, but what is midlife crisis at base level? It's a man or a woman coming to the middle of their life and realizing that they haven't lived the majority of their life the way that they wanted to. So they start doing things that they think are going to make them happy, in the hope that that will fill a void that is not being filled by other things. Yeah, we've joked about that as a society. I remember growing up and hearing it, and it was always kind of a laughing point, when in reality, it's just another case of, as a society, us needing to understand the human element of what it means to exist. I mean, we all are individual. We all have different things that are important to us, but we somehow very easily forget that. What makes me happy won't necessarily make you happy. It sounds like there's some crossover, but at base level, we are not the same. I'm not the same to you. You're not the same to me, vice versa, all over the world. We need to explore what makes us tick, what makes us happy, what makes us fulfilled. And the best way to get there, the best way to mitigate going into a state of poor mental health, is by having open and honest conversations. And to answer your original question, sorry, very convoluted way of getting there. Talking allowed me to comprehend my own existence. Comprehending my own existence allowed me to become comfortable with it. Becoming comfortable with it allowed me to talk to those around me openly, which allowed me to then see a therapist. A therapist helped me understand myself even more, to give me the tools and the understanding that I need to now manage my own well-being practices, habits on a day-to-day basis. So I now have a very, very clear self-awareness of what makes me tick, what I need to do more of, what I need to do less of. If I'm feeling a certain way, ask the question, why is that? What do I do next? Whereas for some people, it might be a case of antidepressants can be a toolbox in that arsenal combined with other things. But the key element is you need to you only understand how to best manage your own mental health by doing the things that will help you manage it. So I'm not saying everybody should go to therapy tomorrow to talk about the mental health, but it might be something of benefit. But if you ever feel like you're not going the direction in life that you want to, and it's starting to make you feel not yourself, lackluster, lacking fulfillment, then just have open and honest conversations with those around you, because you never know what you might unfold, what you might uncover, sorry. And in uncovering these things about yourself, you might be able to take better decisions moving forwards, and you might be able to come to a state of self-awareness that allows you to consider what to do next. And what to do next is entirely up to you as an individual, and it just allows you to control how you feel a little bit more. And the past 18 months we've all had has put us really all up against it. And now more than ever, it's very important to try and constantly explore, constantly try new things, constantly have open and honest conversations to determine what are the tools that you need on your tool belt to be able to effectively manage your mental health on a day-to-day basis. And I'm not gonna give a list of the things that are good for me, because it might be a bit arbitrary and not be very useful for others. But the starting point, at the very least, is talking an open, honest conversation. But the key caveat, and I've seen it online, I've seen people bring it up, is talking is not the solution, but it is almost the key that helps unlock the solution for you as an individual. Because all of my campaigns from November have been based around the strap line of be a man of more words, because I very much believe that as men especially, we can all be more open and honest with our words. But that's not the end game. All that does is allow us to determine the next steps, and it's a starting point of what is ultimately a very complex and wide-reaching issue within the Western world. We have this difficult world to navigate online, in person, jobs, relationships, and the more openly and honestly we have conversations with those around us and with ourselves around where we fit into that, the better we'll be able to look after our overall well-being.
That's great advice. I think looking at it, as you said, there are like tools on your tool belt, because everyone's is going to be different. Mine is going to be different from you, Fergus, which is going to be different from everybody else you speak to. And it's about that self-awareness, that self-reflection, that, you know, what that very simplicity or simplistic approach I take is, you know, make a list of all the things that make you happy, do more of those things, make a list of all the things that make you unhappy, do less of those things, or, you know, insert spending time with people who make you happy and people who make you miserable and unhappy. Like, again, it's such a simplistic approach, but it's something that served me very well when it comes to just taking a little bit of a wider angle view on, you know, effectively figuring out what my tool belt is. Fergus, I just have one final question. I love this conversation. I love your message online, what you put out there to people, the conversation we've had here, destigmatizing mental health, and, you know, coming from somebody who's doing what you're doing in the hybrid world of, you know, endurance events and strength, and somebody that's, you know, can be seen particularly from a physical standpoint, because you're a specimen, like you, as somebody who can do what you do. It's great to hear people, or to hear you breaking down the misconceptions around masculinity and just having these conversations. So I absolutely love that, and I just commend you for it. But my final question, Fergus, is, and I think this is probably very relevant based on the kind of age range when you were having your low points, if you could go back and give advice to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him?
The only person that can determine what makes you you is you. I was presented with several paths that I could choose from, and I chose the one that I felt would make me the most successful in traditional terms. Whereas what I do now, and what I encourage others to do, is to ignore the paths presented to them, but to try and determine what path you would like to take, and then figure out how you're going to get there. But most importantly, to not be afraid to deviate from that path, to change the roadmap, to be adaptable to the situation as you go. Because, I mean, my parents' generation are kind of the generation where you went to school, you went to university, and then you went into one of several professions, whether it was a white collar job, whether it was a blue collar job, whether it was laboring, whatever it was, that it was very clear what direction you went into. But the world that we live in now is so diverse, so incredibly multicultural, so incredibly diverse, and the opportunities for us to do things and to take things into our own control are innumerable. And had I not been presented with these paths and chosen the one that I did, I wish that I'd studied sports science at Loughborough rather than going to Durham or attempting to go to Oxford. But the school thought I could be an Oxford candidate, which meant that they led me and pushed me towards that path because it would look good for them on paper. And that's not a criticism of the school. It's more of a broader question of the education system, in the sense that I believe that as individuals, we all have so much to offer. Individuality is what makes the world as incredible a place as it is. And I know it's a very difficult thing to consider when you're 16 to 18, but what truly makes you happy? What do you enjoy? What do you get excited about? And then just do more of that. And just by accident, by doing more of it over time, you might find a path that actually forms the rest of your life. And finances, paying the bills is one thing, but being successful in my mind is not about your bank account. It's about how you spend your life. And we only exist once. So I really don't see why we can justify spending the majority of our lives doing something that we hate because somebody's told us it's the right direction to go in. The directions we can go in are infinite, but the current system and opportunities presented to us from the age where I started to suffer try and guide us down a path that might not be right for us. So I think it's just being overly critical, overly analytical, and being very consciously aware of what makes, how you feel. If you feel a certain way on a certain day, like you said, write down what makes you feel a certain way, write down what makes you happy, write down what makes you sad, and then you can slowly start to piece together what direction you might be able to go in. And it might take 5 years, it might take 10 years, it might take 1 year, but if you do more of the things that you enjoy, sooner rather than later you're going to find a way to do more of that over more time, and you'll be able to find your ambitions rather than putting yourself in a box, the boxes that society presents to us. Are you going to be a lawyer? Are you going to be a doctor? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? Are you going to go to that big four company to do that graduate scheme? Are you going to go and do that apprenticeship here, that apprenticeship there? Your dad works there. You should work there because all our families for generations have worked there. All this bollocks that's been around for far too long. I think individuality is a beautiful thing, and society tries to sometimes make it not so, but take pride in your individuality and be proud that nobody is as good at being you as you are. And that is something that gives you an incredible amount of freedom and choice and control to be able to take control of the rest of your life sooner rather than later. Because something I brought up before is sort of the rocking chair analogy. If you see yourself on a, like in American TV shows, and you see them out by a coastline sitting in a rocking chair with a blanket on, sort of reflecting on their lives. Think forward 60 years, how many years it is before you're in that situation, and look back on what you're doing now. And is it something that you'd be proud to reflect on? Is it something you'd do the same if you could do it all over again? And that's the question I constantly ask myself is, at the end of each week, have I spent the week doing the right things for the right reasons, or have I been doing them because they're the things that I feel like I should be doing rather than things that I need and want to be doing? And it's not a simple answer. It's not something you need to be able to go, yeah, got it. But it's that constant state of self-reflection and self-awareness that I think will allow us to come to a clearer conclusion sooner rather than later on who we are as an individual and how we want to spend the rest of our lives. Because boxes are dangerous things, and boxes stifle creativity, they stifle individuality, and stifling those things ultimately, in my mind, leads to a very boring world. And I'd like to live in an exciting world, personally.
Fergus, I absolutely love your way with words. I love your outlook on life. I think there's been so much in here in terms of value for people to save this episode, go back and re-listen to it as often as needed. But I'm so grateful for this conversation. I love what you're doing. I love your content online. And I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. A lot of seeing how your mindset works is key and testament to how well you're doing. And again, defining what success looks like for you, I think, is a take-home message from today's podcast, because it's going to be so different based on the person, but I think that comes across brilliantly from the way you speak. Fergus, for those listening, where's the best place for them to connect with you? Is it on Instagram? Is there anywhere else you want to send them now? Give those links. I'll pop them in the show notes for today's episode.
Yep. So Instagram is just at Fergus Crawley. YouTube is Fergus Crawley. And then if you want to tune into my own podcast conversations, then head to The Modern Mind on all major platforms, and you can listen in there. We are on episode 10, and I'm very proud of the first 10 guests I've had, actually. Had everyone from Roman Kemp to Thomas Robson Carnu to Dylan Hartley to the ex-sergeant major of the SBS. We've got a real eclectic mix of conversations in there, all focused around exactly that. What makes the modern mind tick, and how do we break away from these conventional pathways and boxes that society has tried to place us in for so many years? But yeah, the only thing I'm sort of keen to sign off with is just that I don't believe that I have all the answers at all. I've just made a few mistakes in my time that I'm happy to share, in the hope that nobody ever has to feel the way that I did once, because it's not a nice place to be. And if you are listening to this and you're feeling not yourself, or you're feeling in any way depressed or anxious, then as I've said, the most important thing at this stage, I think, is you just have an open dialogue and an open and honest conversation with those around you, because you don't know how beneficial that might be to you or even them, because they might not have any idea. They might be struggling themselves, and we're all in this together. And the more conversations we have, the more of an impact we can have. And that's not an opportunity I'd like to miss out on personally.
Yeah, completely agreed. And for everybody listening, I will link all the links that Fergus gave in the show notes. So head over, subscribe to the podcast, click into the Instagram, subscribe to the YouTube channel. I'll put all of those links in the show notes on BrianKeenFitness.com and in the description wherever you're listening to your podcast. Fergus, keep doing what you're doing, mate. Keep inspiring, keep motivating. Absolutely love it. And mate, as I said, really grateful for this conversation. So thank you so much again.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening, everyone.
There you have it. Hybrid athlete Fergus Crawley on balancing endurance and strength, extreme challenges, and dealing with mental health. We were deep in this episode. So I think if you're somebody that potentially has ever struggled with your mental health side of things, hopefully you got loads from today's podcast. And if you're into endurance, you're into strength, you're into fitness in general, hopefully you got loads from the first half of the podcast. I love these episodes that we get to kind of cover topics that were very close to my heart, particularly mental health, but we also get to balance it with the training side, which again is my passion and my love. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. As always, if you did, be sure to take a screenshot, pop it up on your Instagram, and you can tag myself, Brian, Brian_Keen_fitness, and you can tag Fergus_Crawley on Instagram, or Fergus Crawley on Instagram. That's everything from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.